Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan. Thank you so much for joining us here on the program. I love doing this program. I miss it when I'm not doing it, and I can't get enough when I am doing it, and I'm just grateful for your taking time to join us every Sunday at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m. We do stream live at richarddugan.com, and we archive these programs at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page. So please get the link. It's very easy, richarddugan.com. Go to the radio shows page. Go to the schedules page to see who we have coming up in coming weeks. And also, drop us a note. We'd love to hear from you. That's TMYS. Gee, I wonder what that stands for. Tell me your story. TMYS at richarddugan.com. That's TMYS at richarddugan.com. We'll also be giving you the web address as well as email and other pertinent information regarding our guest today. We're very excited to have on the program each week different guests talking about those new ways of living that we're looking for. We see that the old ways aren't working. Just look around. And we're hoping that you will consider the possibilities that our guests provide to us because they all are working for a better place, a better world, as it were. And so we're encouraging them and encouraging you to participate, be a part of, and again, consider the various options. There are so many choices out there that we don't even know exist. That's the biggest thing of all, is that there are so many things that we can be doing, we just don't know that we can, because we don't know they're there. That's the whole point of education, and I'm a strong advocate of education of all kinds, whether it's formal, institutional, or informal, on the job, or I'm trying to think of the other phrase there as far as street education, if you will, in terms of learning how to exist and converse and cohabitate with other human beings in your community, as well as around the world, and literally around the world with the social media that we have these days. Well, today's program I am very excited about because I like especially the title of this whole movement, and it is a movement it's grown out of our guests' research and teaching. The project support this particular project. It supports marginalized people, mainly women and people of color, who heal the relational and social terrors in their souls and launch revolutions in their lives. My guest today is Janine Staples, and I want to thank you so much for joining us and sharing with us about this wonderful project called the Supreme Love Project. And thank you for being on Tell Me Your Story.
Wow, Richard, thank you so much. That was a great introduction. I'm feeling excited about this interview now, too.
Well, I have to say that you know, we hear the term love used a lot. And first of all, I want to thank you for not saying the Quantum Love Project. Quantum, that word has lost its magnanimousness in my esteem at least at this particular. Maybe it could come back. It could come back. But nonetheless, we're talking about a very large, universal project here dealing with love. And I guess what we're going to talk first about, I love to do this at the beginning of programs like this, defining terms, so that people know where you are coming from. Right. What do you mean when you use this four-letter word, love? What are you referring to? Define it for us.
So I'm really trying to differentiate between self-love and supreme love. What we learn usually as women, because we're socialized into a lot of sort of deconstructed attitudes about our identity. A lot of times women don't know who they are unless someone tells them who they are. We're not necessarily given the same benefits as boys or men to grow up, with their autonomy to define ourselves. So the idea of self-love gets a lot of play in communities where women live. And it has to do with trying to patchwork low self-esteem, a lack of self-confidence, a lack of self-respect that comes from adolescence and rolls into adulthood. So self-love gets passed around quite a bit. And in that framework, love tends to be very shallow and surface. It has to do with understanding and, sort of appreciating the way you look, or appreciating sort of quirks and tendencies in your personality and learning to, quote unquote, value yourself so that you can experience maybe the love that you've lost or love that you missed or love that you maybe don't believe that you have. And so supreme love is actually both a complementary project to that and also a counter project to that. It's complementary in that it graduates to a different level that self-love cannot attain and cannot reach. And it's a counter project in that it highlights some of the ways that self-love fails us as women and doesn't actually fulfill itself when we attempt to practice self-love. So when I talk about love specifically, I'm talking about both a spiritual, material, emotional, sexual, social, psychological, respect, compassion, and wisdom for oneself, and then also for the world.
A tall order, to say the very least.
Pretty tall. Yeah. Pretty tall.
And yet it's something that is, you know, beyond needed, or especially right now in our day and time with some of the challenges that we face both in our nation and the world, in our own communities and so forth. And we are really trying to better understand ourselves and the people around us to be able to have those kinds of relationships that are meaningful and that can bring about the kind of change that we want in ourselves, in our immediate circle of friends and family, but also in our community and in our world. Where did you begin with this process? It sounds to me, and certainly I could sit here and I could go to your website, I could pull up your bio and say, this is where she comes from, and this, it's so much better when the guest tells us where they came from to create this wonderful concept.
Yeah. So yeah, I agree. My bio is on the web and anybody can read it. And it's, you know,
sure.
It's very academic. It's all about my professional life. But the way that I came to supreme love really came through my personal life primarily. And it happened that I was a struggling codependent for many, many years throughout my early part of my adulthood. And that left me really, really subject to a great many of relational and social terrors, which I define in my book, I define on the web. Those terrors range in variation from what I call little t terrors, mm-hmm. all the way up to big T terrors with a capital T. And relational and social terrors are basically the microaggressions all the way up to the macroaggressions that any girl or woman could experience, actually any person, but I focus specifically on girls and women. And so I was just bombarded with lots of them. So the little T terrors are the microaggressions that one would experience in intimate partnership or just in social spheres when you're going about the course of your daily life. A little T terror is when they're almost imperceptible to the person who's not experiencing them. So those are the ways that you're objectified or dehumanized by being avoided, ignored, dismissed, doubted, disregarded, whether it's professionally or socially or emotionally or relationally. So to give you an example, a relational terror might be when a woman is dating a man, let's say, and he's emotionally neglectful, so he doesn't call for days at a time, or he breaks plans constantly, or he does the work of gaslighting, which I don't know if some of your viewers might be familiar or listeners might be familiar with or not. Gaslighting is a tendency the people who suffer from narcissistic personality disorder do, and it's a way of tripping up a person so that they doubt their concept of reality. It's where a person backpedals from the truth or twists and contorts a statement or a question so that the person who's the recipient of that question starts to doubt their memory, start to doubt your concept. And those are little T terrors. And they're plentiful in the lives of a lot of girls and women. They come in the effect of body shaming, again, emotional neglect, psychological tripping, or also just the ways that the media, for example, create pictures and montages of what's desirable and what's beautiful, and then berates a woman for maybe not holding up that standard. So I suffered a lot of relational terrors as an individual, and even some big T terrors. A big T terror is something that's more physical, it's more concretized, it's more material. So where a little T terror is anchored usually to the soul, has to do with cognitive processes and emotional processes. A big T terror has to do with your flesh and your body. Mm-hmm. So that's where a person might be raped or molested or beaten. What I tell people to help them understand is that a big T terror is something you can file a police report about. Mm-hmm. A little T terror, you can't. And so basically over the course of a long time, several years, when I accumulated lots of little T terrors and one or two big T terrors, I reached a breaking point, essentially, and I had the great benefit and privilege of being an educational anthropologist, so I had my research to lean into to help me to figure out a way out of my despair and out of my panic attacks, you know, out of some of the ways that my soul was hardening to life and to people and causing me to become more and more reclusive and touchy and fretful. And so I found Supreme Love as basically a methodology for encountering myself at a deep level with a greater space of compassion and respect and intimacy than I had ever known before. Once I started to practice Supreme Love as a methodological framework for my identity, I started to get very clear about how I could be a better citizen, a better partner, a better sister, a better educator, a better scholar, just a better human being to make an impact on the world that was not self-centered, but that was really based in fairly ancient wisdoms.
Janine Staples is my guest, and we are talking about the Supreme Love Project. It is written about, of course, in the Revelations of Azure, the Toward Supreme Love in Self. She's the founder of the Supreme Love Project. You are also, at least, again, looking at your bio, you are also very well educated, at least as far as I can tell from your bio, because I don't know what they teach at Harvard. I've never been. But I've heard a lot about it. I have many pictures of Harvard. Education to me is like when it is denied an individual for whatever reason. And that's why when I see stories of other countries and the ways in which they treat women specifically and prohibit them from getting an education, I'm sitting here thinking, number one, how is it that you think you have the right to keep these individuals, men or women, you know, male or female, from furthering their life's potential? But then I think about that lost potential. Especially, and I'm trying to remember the young woman's name. She was shot and went on a crusade, basically. I want to say Malala.
Yes, Malala.
I saw her on an interview with Jon Stewart a couple of years ago, and just was taken by this woman and her crusade, if you will. And I feel very strongly about it, especially because of the education that I didn't get. I've learned more. Mm-hmm. In doing these interviews over the last nearly 40 years, yeah, than the 12 years that I spent in primary and secondary, and let alone post-secondary, although I give post-secondary a great deal of credit. But I started hearing things in these interviews I'd never heard of before. I didn't know some of these things even existed. And I mean, we did a series in 2014 on mythology. Yeah. Now, I'm familiar with many of the Greek and Roman gods and mm-hmm. some of the general stories. And I'll look up in the sky and I can see Orion's belt and then, of course, all of the different characters that are laid out in the stars and the stories that go along with them. I've heard some of them. And then I began to hear how these stories impact our lives.
Yes.
And I thought, oh, my God. God, I'm going to sue. No, I not seriously. I'm going to take them to task because they didn't give me what I needed and I didn't know that I needed it until now.
Right.
And yet, where would I be today if I had gotten that information? And then I ask these questions that I suppose would get a giant H emblazoned on my forehead for being a heretic. for asking the kinds of questions that challenge the status quo.
Yeah.
And one in particular dealing with the economy. Who says this is the only economic system there is? Just because we haven't tried something else doesn't mean there isn't something else out there, mm-hmm. you know, or maybe in religion or spirituality. Or even in the educational system. I mean, I love some of these schools, and especially depicted in some television programs, where it's the most non-traditional, non-dogmatic educational process that these kids and young adults are going through. But man, are they learning stuff, and are they curious? They're fighting for the information almost, you know? And I say that metaphorically or euphemistically. It's like, and we should all have that passion. So when you start talking about teaching women in particular, hey, and by the way, I grew up with four sisters and I married my first marriage was with a woman who was totally blind. And there were a few women that came into my sphere of existence throughout my life. And thank God my sisters don't fall into this category. My first wife does, and some of these other women fell into the category of being, as I deemed it then, damaged. And the damage was done by men, and I began to feel ashamed for being a man. I said, oh man, I would change my gender now because I am so ashamed of being a part of this particular aspect of the species that has done this kind of damage that now I have to deal with in relationships.
Yeah,
it's frustrating as all get out. And but that's nothing compared to what, of course, you and other women have gone through. I understand that, at least on one level. So when you begin to talk with people, women in particular, and you used an interesting word, and I actually like the word that you used in here, marginalized.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
As a kid growing up, I would have to say from an educational standpoint, I was marginalized because I was born legally blind and was actually almost treated with kid gloves. I had, the big print books and the talking books and all of the aids necessary. But I just kind of skated through and they just passed me on through. And my present wife, the same thing. She has dyslexia, but they just passed her on through. And it's not until the last 15 or 20 years, and we've been together about that long, and she can read out loud in front of people for the first time. Mm-hmm. But she was never given the chance without any kind of ridicule. Mm-hmm. You talk about the big T and the little T in terms of terror.
Yes.
It seems to me that the damage is almost as devastating with the little T's that is done with the big T's. Am I fair in my assessment there?
Little T terrors are far more damaging than big T terrors.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
I think a lot of people miss that message when I describe a big T terror because they think, well, what could be worse than being molested or raped or hit in the face, you know, with a closed fist or, brutalized by police or, you know, any of those physical sort of caustic experiences. But what ends up happening is two things that a person would need to remember. A big T terror is a trauma for sure. I would not take anything from a big T terror. It is a trauma for sure. Mm-hmm. One issue or two issues that we have to remember when we're talking about big T terrors is first, they often operate as singular events. Now, there are, of course, people who are ritualistically abused. If you're a woman who's in a household with a man who batters you, then your big T terror could happen any day, every day. And that's something to, there's something to be said about that. But I think typically, though, a big T terror is an event that happens that can be singular. And secondly, a big T terror is something you can write a police report about. You can get help from the state to manage and take care of a big T terror and persecute the person who exacted that big T terror. The other thing to remember about a big T terror, or there are lots of resources available to help you pass through it and manage it. There are social services, there are psychologists, there are social workers and therapists, Reiki workers. There are lots of people who help you to get through a big T terror. Little T terrors, though, like I said, are barely perceptible to the people who are not necessarily experiencing them. They also are more plentiful. They're also more subject to happen on a regular basis and over a course of time, that it basically equates to death by 1,000 paper cuts. And so little T terrors are elusive. They are plentiful. They're not mediated well. There's no one to call to help you with them as far as a state representative, someone who's operated from the state. And then you also have to do a lot of convincing to get people to believe that you're experiencing these little T terrors, which causes women in particular to be rendered alone in relation to them more often than not. So in my book, and when I say my book, what I'm saying in my idea and my framework for the project, a little T terror, a person who suffered many, many little T terrors is often just as pained and torn down as someone who's experienced one big T terror.
Okay. I would like to ask you a question about something that came out, if you will, in October of 2016. I don't want to get into the political conversation, but I want to get into the conversation regarding some verbiage that was used from a video that was released during our 2016 presidential campaign. And I don't think I need to go any further in terms of describing this, because I think you know what I'm talking about.
Okay. There were lots of things that happened in October. I think I might need a little bit more specificity to make sure we're on the same page.
How about a conversation on a bus?
Oh, okay. I think that was 2015.
That was 2016. Well, it may have happened in 2015, but the video was not released until 2016.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious, again, all politics aside, and I have talked with athletes, okay, religious, secular athletes, it didn't make any difference. And I asked them, that kind of conversation, is that the kind of stuff you guys talked about in the locker room? To a man, all of them said no. That kind of conversation, we've never had those kinds of conversations, not even remotely, okay? Mm-hmm. I'm curious as to where that stacks up as far as a big T or little T. What does that do to a woman's esteem, if you will, place in society, expectations of fair and respectful treatment when something like that seems as though it were just, in a manner of speaking, it were just brushed aside?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what we need to know and be very clear about is the type of misogynistic rhetoric that you're referring to is called a gateway terror. Mm-hmm. That's a gateway.
Okay.
It is the precedent to a big T terror, because what ends up happening is the person, if let's say for argument's sake, it's a man, particularly if it's a white man who utters that kind of misogynistic rhetoric with the intent to commit or even the ideation to commit the types of sexual, social, physical practices that are being quote unquote joked about or bragged about, that person is essentially coaching themselves into that kind of behavior or advocating that type of behavior for others, green lighting that type of behavior for subordinates, and modeling a practice of abuse that is not easily undone. What that does, that misogynistic rhetoric, is it creates a gateway for a culture of violence and abuse that I really cannot overstate. And, you know, it's interesting, Richard. There are many, many people who would dismiss what I'm describing right now, and they would say that my explanation of that incident is hyperbolic and dramatic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, unfounded. However, if we trace the narrative structures of misogyny through their course of action, we can trace them almost unilaterally directly to an assault. We can trace them to almost always directly to some sort of violation, a physical violation, because those are gateway rhetorics that open up a door for behavior. It cannot be overstated that they're very, very dangerous. Those rhetorics objectify women and dehumanize women, and they're serious in and of themselves for that reason. They're also serious, Richard, because they couch that dehumanization in a joke. So it removes some of the sting, mm-hmm. and it causes the recipient of that joke to be numbed to the effect of the joke. And so it's like smoke and mirrors. It's very, it's a confusing situation to be in, mm-hmm. for a boy or a man. It's a very confusing situation to be in for a girl or a woman, particularly if you are a girl or a woman who's been trained and coached to accept that kind of joking, to accept that kind of rhetoric, and also to be shamed if you question it at all.
Yeah. Janine Staples is my guest. She's the author of The Revelations of Asher. I want to talk a little bit about that as well as we continue in our program, talking about the Supreme Love Project. And by the way, dovetailing off of what you've just said, from a spiritual perspective, the concept, if you will, of creation is the levels, I should say, of creation are, first, there's a thought. Then there's the word about the thought, and then there's the action. So what you have just stated is just that, that, all right, you might have, I'm sure we've all had the thoughts. Mm-hmm. That's okay in one sense, okay? You recognize I had those thoughts, not great to have in my head, so I need to work on, you know, better inputting new info for better thoughts. And then you start speaking them and then you start acting upon them. It's one of those aspects, too, I have to say, Janine, that I'm still troubled by, especially in the political arena. And again, we're not talking politics here, but in terms of campaigns, whether it was the 2016, I don't even like to use the word campaign, but but be that as it may, or any other. And at the end of these campaigns, I keep hearing the phrases, all right, now let's all join together and sing Kumbaya for a greater city, state, nation, world. It doesn't work if you have been saying words that have been demeaning and hurtful and on and on and on. You can't brush it away by, and this is the phrase that I keep hearing every cycle, whether it's midterms, whether it's every year, wherever community you live, they say, hey, that's just politics. And I say, that's just BS. Mm-hmm. If you didn't mean the words that you said, you should not have said them. Mm-hmm. So don't say what you don't mean and mean what you say. Because here's the other aspect of it. And this goes more to, I think, what you're talking about in terms of the treatment, not just of women, but of men in general, of men as well as just people in general. When you're that way and you're saying those kinds of things, whether it's misogynistic, whether it's anarchistic, whatever the verbiage is that is not constructive to building relationships, mm-hmm. how do you expect to go into, let's just say, a business situation to conduct business to get a particular project or job for your company if they can't trust the words that you say? I'm not talking about, you know, saying phrases and things of this nature. I'm talking about meaning what you say and saying what you mean. Mm-hmm. It's like if those are the kinds of things that you say during a campaign, but then at the end of the campaign, I didn't mean them, then how can I trust you to tell me the truth now that, let's say, you're holding this particular position? Because you said back there you didn't mean those words. It was all a game. How can I be sure you're not playing that same game with me now? And this happens in relationships, too, especially if, let's say, you have a person who is an addict of whatever. It doesn't have to be drugs. It could be alcohol. It could be behavior patterns and so forth. And they keep telling you, I'm sorry, and it'll never happen again. And it happens again and again. It's like, when do you get it that, I'm sorry, I don't believe you?
You know, it's interesting. As I'm listening to you, there's two things that popped into my mind. The first is a saying that my father used to repeat pretty frequently. Do you want to hear it?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Well, of course.
My dad used to say, how you do one thing is how you do everything.
Thank you.
Like, yeah. And when I think about the excuses that people make for bad behavior, I am not hard. I'm not hardened. You know, I work on being non-judgmental because we all make mistakes and we all have space to grow. And that's not going to end until you die. However, when a person's repeated behavior and repeated rhetoric show no sign of changing or ceasing, evolving, or being repealed, then one does need to take for granted that how that person does one thing is how they will do other things. And like you said, there's no room to differentiate between locker room talk and boardroom talk, or the corresponding locker room mentality and the boardroom mentality. We are not inconsistent in that way when doing our humanity. So I agree with you. The other thing that came to mind, in addition to what my dad used to say, how you do one thing is how you do everything, I'm reminded of the idea of gaslighting. And what I talked about before in terms of describing a relational terror so that our listeners could understand what I mean by that, mm-hmm. I referenced the term gaslighting and I aligned it to NPD. That's NPD, the narcissistic personality disorder. It's a trick and a trademark behavior of a person who suffers from that disorder. And gaslighting does come when a person does backpedal off of their behavior or attempt to downplay a behavior or attempt to twist the memory or the recollection of a recipient of a rhetoric or behavior so that that person who's received the rhetoric or behavior doubts themselves mm-hmm. or questions their reality so that the person who's doing the twisting can maintain authority, the authority to dismiss the person who's the recipient, to downplay that person, to diminish that person, or to call that person quote unquote crazy. And gaslighting is a very, very powerful and sadistic trick that happens in interpersonal relationships between people who have disordered personhoods. And when I think about its effect on a national or global level, I shudder, Richard. I know what that one trait can do in the course of relationship between two people, and it is disastrous in its effect. It crushes people. It confuses people. It causes so much discord, so much confusion, such a lack of trust, such a lack of confidence, that when I sort of expand that notion and imagine it happening on a corporate level, a national level, or God forbid, a global level, it signifies to me really a powerful end of era. It's terrifying. Mm-hmm. It really is terrifying.
Let me play devil's advocate and respond to that by saying, oh, come on, just get over it. That helps build character.
No, it doesn't. First of all, what I would say to that is the devil has enough advocates. So, you know, let's bypass that.
Okay.
And second, I would say that it actually does not build character. The type of tenacity and perseverance that one would need to build up in order to deal with suffering and deal with hardship has almost climaxed in terms of humanity. When I talk about marginalized people in the Supreme Love Project, I'm talking specifically about women, like in relation to men. We're more marginalized than men are in mm-hmm. any society mm-hmm. on the planet.
Couldn't agree with you more.
Right. And then people of color who are women, like me, are even more marginalized. And then people who are disabled are even more marginalized. People who are gay or lesbian or transgender are even more marginalized. So the way that you can think about marginalization is you can think about the ways that people occupy identity markers that push them further and further and further and further out, away from the center, where there is respect, where there are resources, where there is innocence, where there is righteousness, where there are accolades, where there are praise, there's praise. So when you're marginalized, you're just push farther to the edge. And of course, a marginalized person does develop a greater capacity for managing suffering than a centralized person. And that's par for the course. However, what you're talking about in terms of being an advocate for a devilish or an evil mentality and say, oh, you know, dealing with this gaslighting on a regional or national or global level will just build character or help our nation to get stronger, help our citizenry to be more agile. I argue against that because we don't have the practice or capacity to manage that level of confusion, of discord, of dissent. And to make a bet to say that we'll gather the resources is a very high risk. I wouldn't say that we won't gather the resources and we won't figure it out and we won't develop a greater capacity for managing this suffering and overcoming all manner of suffering. But what I would say is it's not a safe bet to make.
History. Yeah, history is not going to back that up as far as making that bet.
Right.
You'd lose. You're going to lose because history is not on our side in that regard.
Yeah.
By the way, if you took it from the verbal to the physical and, mm-hmm. and converted the verbal into warfare, look at what's going on around the world now in warfare.
Yep.
All right.
Yeah.
So if we convert the verbal, I'll call it dialogue, that we've got going on right now in this country in particular, but around the world, like that, you know, that somehow we have managed to spark. You don't have to worry about World War III. We've already devastated the landscape and the citizen, the civilization. It's over. Okay. And that's, as I said, that's converting it from verb, because that's the next level. As I said, from a spiritual universal perspective, creation, if you will, of whatever, creation of destructive means as well, starts with a thought, and then it goes to the words, and then it goes to the actions.
Yeah, it's true. And the other thing that I would add, Richard, to really nail down what you're saying, that is the course of creation. Thought, word, action. That is the movement of creation. And as human beings, we're all co-creators. We all have the capacity to generate all manner of materiality through spirit, ourselves as spirits. This is the other thing that's really a very important component of that trajectory from thought, word, and action. And it is emotion. Emotionality is the sticky substance that causes the connective tissue to make all that movement happen. Because we don't generate thoughts and words and actions without an emotional incentive. Mm-hmm. We're hungry for connection, for touch, for taste and smell, which are sensuous, but then also to feel things, to feel exuberance, to feel titillated, to feel powerful, to feel visible, to feel connected. And so when that trajectory, the thought, and then the word, and the action need an engine, they need fuel mm-hmm. or fire to make them go, it comes in the form of emotionality. that renders us through spirituality to materiality. It's our emotions that cause us to move. And so the women who come to the Supreme Love Project are often operating in an extreme. They're either at the bottom of the barrel, just spent of emotionality. They are voids. They're almost like ghosts. They are waifs of themselves because they have poured out so much, because they feel so confused and they feel so ill-equipped to do their womanhood wondrously. Or they are at the height of emotionality, which means they are frantic, anxious, riddled with stress, and hyperreactive, overreactive, hypersensitive. And there's very little balance in emotionality. And what we do in the Supreme Love Project is we bring ourselves back to a balance by developing our lover identity so that it can be supreme. A supreme lover identity is what I advocate for. It's what I practice myself. And it's what I teach women how to build.
We're talking with Janine Staples. She is the creator, the founder of the Supreme Love Project. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story. We're going to continue our conversation with Janine in just a moment, but we want you to stay with us as well because we're going to come back, Janine, and we're going to work the other side. And I'll explain that when we come back here on Tell Me Your Story.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're talking with Janine Staples. She is the founder of the Supreme Love Project. By the way, if you put a .com on that, guess where that'll take you? To the Supreme Love website, the Supreme Love Project website. So thesupremeloveproject.com. And Janine, again, thank you for staying with us here on the program. As I mentioned, going to break, I want to go to the other side now because we could sit here all day, justifiably so, and we could rip and tear at these, because it is individuals as well as cultures, communities, segments of society that are perpetrating the issues that we are talking about here that are damaging people. By the way, I have to say that when you broke down the marginalized groups, the only thing I can think of, the worst person to be in this society, in this world today, would be a disabled transgendered gay black woman.
Very much so.
You know, now, and I say that facetiously, but because I know I'm sure there's someone out there that way, and I tell you what, you deserve all the credit in the world. And by the way, on that subject, if an individual is not happy and in their own skin, they need to find a way to be happy. I used to be in a position where I'm thinking, plastic surgery? Are you kidding? Come on, you know, you came into this world. But my God, if you're not happy and it doesn't, if it's holding you back, and I've seen people, men and women, who have had certain surgical procedures, and man, their confidence level just goes through the roof. Mm-hmm. And man, they are pursuing things they weren't pursuing before that. So I'm all for people finding their place. They find it. Not somebody else finds it for them. They find their place in their community, in their society, if you will. But let's talk about the other side. Let's talk about I'm not even sure what word to use. I want to say perpetrators, but maybe there's another word to use. How can we help them? I mean, they're just people here in this world going through their lives, trying to learn. At the same time, so are we. As you know, it's been said that this is just a schoolhouse and we're all here. We're all students. Well, Right. They're students too. And it's not like we want to imprison them all for all of the evil things they've thought, said, or done, although some of them should be, obviously. But, you know, how do you, in the Supreme Love Project, how do you balance the love and the care and the compassion that you show for the, and again, for lack of a better word, for the victims, mm-hmm. for the perpetrator? Is there a balance, or where do we go with that?
So in the Supreme Love Project, I do not advocate for women to help people. I want to let that sit. I do not advocate that women help people. That's not my goal. What I say to the women in the Supreme Love Project is your job is to heal yourself and heal the world. Heal yourself and heal the world. And I make that distinction very clear because about 9 times out of 10, Richard, a woman who comes into the Supreme Love Project has been attempting to help other people her entire life. She has tried to help her parents, her grandparents, her spouse, her children, her employer. She has tried to help her neighbors. She has taken on other people's problems and other people's projects as her own to form what's called enmeshment. And what that does is it reifies the fact that so many women, especially those who come into the Supreme Love Project, do avoidance. A woman avoids being with herself, focusing on herself, building her own identity, understanding her own interior constitution, developing and constructing healthy, reasonable boundaries that she knows how to articulate and uphold with reverence in such a way that she displaces herself so that she almost becomes vacuous. So in the project, we don't talk about helping people. We talk about healing yourself and heal the world. And that is based on the principle that spiritually, if we take for granted the fact that there is no separation, that's just an illusion that gets perpetrated by patriarchy, we can say that the minute a woman focuses on herself, on healing her own internal wounds, on claiming her unclaimed parts, on naming her disowned attributes, and bringing coherence and wholeness to herself, as a catalyst in her household, as a catalyst in her community, many, 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 many other people are affected. She does not need to go out and do evangelism. She does not need to go out and proselytize. She does not need to go out actively and attempt to argue or explain or plead or beg or chase anyone to change their ideological views, to alter their perspectives. No, her job is to heal herself and heal the world. So my advocacy says to a woman, heal yourself and then go out being at the center of your feminine power in every relationship, every endeavor, every action, every behavior that you commit to, and the reverberating effect of your lover identity will make itself known.
So the Supreme Love Project is only dealing with one side of the equation because that's more than enough to deal with right now. We don't need to deal with the other side. If they want to get some kind of help or assistance, they finally develop a conscience, if you will, because quite honestly, that's what it takes. And they decide they get help, they will have to seek out help and assistance because it's a big enough job, it sounds like, for an individual, for a woman, to heal herself. It's a big enough job for her to find her way in this world after everything that's, in a manner of speaking, been done to her that she's experienced.
Oh, yeah. It's a huge job. It's a huge job. And the other thing that we learn in the Supreme Love Project is too often when a woman attempts to mind someone else's business, she is doing avoidance. She is avoiding herself. She's avoiding being alone with herself to mind her own thoughts, to do what I call a deep excavation of her own soul. And that I do not advocate for. We don't do avoidance. We don't do escapism. We don't do disassociation by minding other people's business. So we focus sincerely on a woman healing herself. And once a woman's identity is supreme, once she is a supreme lover, my God, her purpose is clear. Her force is established. Her influence is undeniable. And she can go about fulfilling her purpose, whatever purpose she determines, but that's determined between her and her creator.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I do understand where you're coming from. And I guess it's for another program and another guest, a different guest, to deal with that other part of the equation. Because as we've just said, it's too much. It's just too much. You can't do both if you're trying to take care of yourself. And I have learned through my wife, and she's been through survival training and so forth, The first number one rule of survival training is take care of number one. Because if you don't, you can't help number two.
Nope. Can't.
So that it makes perfect sense. It really does. Now, you have this wonderful work, certainly of the Supreme Love Project. I'm making sure that I get all of the words in there. Because the Love Project is something totally different. I don't know what it is, nor do I care at this point. But you you also have a book.
Yes.
That is out there. That is, it basically, I guess it spells out, so to speak, the Supreme Love Project. It's called The Revelations of Asher. Can you give us a little bit of a synopsis of what we would find between the covers?
Yes. So the Revelations of Asher is a book that's based on 2 years of ethnographic data. I spent 2 years with a group of women studying their terror narratives. Studying their understanding of relational and social terrors. And what I did was I compiled their terror narratives in the book so that anything and everything that a person reads in the book, about 95% of it, is data. It's real data. So I took transcripts, I took journal entries, I took email correspondences, instant messages, and I reworked and mashed up those narrative structures to create stories that represent the women's, the group participants' stories in life and love. And so the book is a wonderful journey of sort of a course of experience between the fragmented selves of a group of women to talk about their relational and social terrors in life and love during a particular period of time in their lives. The closing of the book, after you read the stories that the fragments itself share, talks specifically about what supreme love can do to heal those terrors, how supreme love, as I'm going to use the word you don't like, as a quantum force.
That's okay.
It's supreme love is essentially Christ consciousness. So the back end of the book talks specifically about what supreme love is and how supreme love can be developed in order to heal the terrors in our soul and launch these revolutions in our lives. It's a powerful, exciting, you know, very unique book.
I'm curious, as a not just as a Harvard graduate, but obviously you have your PhD.
I have my EdD, yes, my doctor in education, yes.
All right. I'm curious as to how that felt for you when you could put DR, doctor, in front of your name. I mean, that seems, and by the way, I've worked at this particular station I'm at now for over 9 years. And I have been associated with a number of people, programmers here, who have gone on to pursue their PhDs while doing their programs here on the station. So I know more doctors now than I did when I started.
Yeah.
And it seems to be, as far as the educational process, almost a rite of passage. Now, I have a moniker that someone gave me called Dr. D, but I don't have a PhD or an EdD or any other acronyms or letters behind my name. They call me the audio physician. But I'm curious as for you, because that's a long process of and a hell of a commitment to make for anybody. How did that feel when that was finished and you got to see that on your name?
You know, it's interesting. It feels really good now. I think that some people would agree. I'm a classically trained educational anthropologist, which means I went for my degree full time, and that's all I did for 5 years, 6 years almost. And I was completely immersed and absorbed everything in relation to my training as a scholar and as an educator for those years. And by the time I defended my dissertation and got my credentials, it actually felt like a real denouement. It was like, it was like a thud. Like, oh, that's it. The actual earning of the credentials was more exhilarating and exciting and painful and triumphant than actually getting the credentials. But then I think when I got my first job as a professor and I started to recognize the way that other people responded to my life's work and my skill set, that it became more real to me, and I feel honored. I feel deeply honored. I feel very privileged to have trained with the people that I've trained with at these amazing institutions, and it's a privilege and an honor. It really feels good. It feels good.
Yeah, I loved going to school, and I've been only through vocational, and then of course junior college back in mm-hmm. Phoenix. But it was like I loved going to school and absorbing everything I could for the first time in my life. Even after the 12 years of primary and secondary, I wanted to be there. I wanted to take this stuff in, you know. And then when I do some of these interviews, like when we did the mythology series called Mythosophia, Exploring the Depths of Myth and Wisdom, at first I felt so inadequate because I was sitting across the table from a guy who is pursuing his PhD in mythology, and he's my co-host, and the questions he's asking are so erudite and so scholarly. And I would sit there and I would ask questions, and they were coming from, as I often tell people, the universe. You know, the universe asks the questions in these interviews. I'm just along for the ride. But we had so much fun doing it, and I not only met some incredible people, but had the most amazing conversations, such as this one I'm having with you, Janine.
Thank you.
And I wish there was a way to convert that which I have experienced into classroom credit towards a master's or a PhD. I don't even have a bachelor's, let alone anything else. But again, it goes back to what I said at the beginning of the program about the importance, the value of education. Now, and again, this is a little bit taking us down a different kind of road, but I think it still applies. Why did you choose the institutions, be it Harvard or otherwise, that you chose over others that maybe even abroad for that matter, that could have given you equal to or greater than the knowledge base that you have? You know, and again, I'm not saying, well, so why'd you choose Harvard over Yale? No. You know, why did you make, what was behind the choice, the decision process of saying, I'm going to go here as opposed to over here?
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. I don't know if anyone's asked me that question before. I always knew what I wanted to do. And so in around, I'd say, middle school, I knew that I wanted to go to Howard University. I knew that I wanted to go to Harvard University, and I knew that I wanted to go to the University of Pennsylvania. And I didn't know what order I would go in. Well, I knew that I'd go to Howard first, but I didn't know the order of anything else. And I chose those institutions for a few reasons. Those reasons have definitely evolved as I've grown into my adulthood. I think I chose Howard University because it's the mecca of Black intelligentsia in the world. And it's the epicenter for knowledge building among diasporic people anywhere. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to be in that context and be trained by those people and be trained with those people, my people. I chose Harvard because it's the oldest college in the United States of America. And I chose the University of Pennsylvania because it's the oldest university. And also because I'm from Philadelphia and I wanted to be a part of that community in those contexts. So I chose the institutions that to me represent the most rigorous and most admired and respected spaces for higher learning in the world. And I set those goals for myself because I wanted to prove to myself that I could do it. And I felt really scared along the way. I felt really excited along the way. I felt intimidated at some points. I felt really accomplished at other points. It gave me a really broad wealth of experience going through all of those institutions. I felt at home at each of them mm-hmm. For different reasons. And it was just the perfect pattern of education for me.
Define for me diasporic. This is how I learn.
So the diaspora is the movement, the transnational movement of Black people from Africa and the Caribbean to other parts of the world. So diasporic movement is marked from, gosh, from the 1300s all the way up to the 1400s through the slave trades in the Caribbean and the United States, and even into diasporic markings within the West, in the United States, for example, from the South to the North and to the West Coast. And so when I talk about diasporic peoples, I'm talking specifically about people who are Black and claim Blackness from the continent and from the Caribbean and in the U.S.
I'm curious as to your desire and choice, obviously, to, as you, and this is, these are your words, not mine, to be amongst your people.
Yeah.
As opposed to having a more diverse experience of being amongst other people who are not necessarily your people. Had you not had that experience as you were growing up and said, hey, I need this, as opposed to, I need a more diverse experience of cultures. So I'm going to go somewhere where I can intermingle with all different races and colors and creeds and sexes and so forth and genders and what have you. Can you share with us a little bit about that? And you can be more general if you'd like, but I'm just curious. Certainly we all want to hang with people that we know or that we have something in common with. And if I'm being too simplistic, is skin color enough or cultural background enough?
Yeah, it depends on who you ask. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, it's very difficult for a person who's been centralized, particularly in terms of race and gender, to grasp the vantage point of someone who has not been. And my choice and need, my great, great need to be at Howard University came out of my desire to be specifically with Black people, Black and brown people who were in positions of authority, who were scholars, who were activists, who were educators, who were coaches, who were artists, who were politicians, so that I could evolve and graduate and mature my understanding of myself. Growing up in a world that is as whitewashed as our world causes particularly Black girls and boys, little people, to have a fairly warped perception of themselves and an underdeveloped one at best. And so for many, there's lots of need to be in a space where you can see representations of yourself that are affirming and that are real, that are very diverse. There's so much diversity within the historically Black colleges and universities in the United States that it's just mind-blowing the amount of diversity that exists. And also to understand the reality of that texture and that community and own it and call it your own is an incredible boost for self-esteem and self-confidence that you just can't get outside in other spaces. You can't. And so, yeah, it was a really important move for me. It was something that I would do 100,000 times over. It actually set me up to be successful at Harvard. It set me up to be successful at Penn. It set me up to be successful now. I'm a tenured professor at a Research One institution at a Big Ten university in the United States. In the university where I work, there are about 3 or 4% of the faculty are Black faculty, and half of that are Black women faculty. And so out of many tens of thousands, actually hundreds of thousands of faculty across the globe, I can name the number of Black women who actually have my specialization. And so being in that kind of space, in that kind of world, and having to be a contender and an authority in my field, I needed a foundation to build my self-esteem and my confidence in a way that I would not have gotten otherwise.
You know, as a supervisor hiring people back in the 80s, early 90s at a radio station, I had the challenge of hiring, and the way I put it was, the most qualified individuals. I don't care whether they're male or female or what their skin color is. I want the most qualified individual. And interestingly enough, what I found was that the most qualified individuals were usually women. And I even hired a couple of women of color as well, of different nationalities, not just black women or what have you. And we had a number of women that worked there. And I was very proud of that fact. Matter of fact, I sought out female candidates over male candidates. So you might call me a reverse discriminator. But no, I wasn't reverse discriminating. I was looking for the best people. And a lot of the guys that would come in the door, when I would tell them, okay, here's what you're going to be paid and here's what your job description is, you guys don't pay me enough to do that. Well, there's the door. Thank you. Because this is the job description. And the women didn't have a problem with the job description. And I didn't treat them any differently than anybody else in the building. And quite honestly, they helped me. They taught me a lot in terms of, and I'm still learning, reaping those lessons, if you will, that they taught me in terms of relating with people. One woman, as a matter of fact, I remember I insulted her, but I didn't realize I had insulted her when I said, in terms of your Mexican heritage, and she stopped me right away. She says, I am not Mexican. I'm Spanish. Her family was not from Mexico. Her family was from Spain, an assumption on my part. And I was dealing with a gentleman and his crew that would come in to produce a Spanish language program, okay? And my first experience of him was, oh, God, what an arrogant SOB. My God, he thinks he owns the place. And I shared this with her. She says, you're misreading it. That's not arrogance. That's confidence. He's confident in what he's doing. And if he's offending you, he's not doing it on purpose. See, she picked up on that. So these are the kinds of things that I'm still bringing up from that long ago experience in that regard. And it seems to me that a lot of people, they're missing out. I mean, huge losses in awareness of the way other people are and the way other people live and the way they think and believe, on all levels. Because, we're shutting ourselves off. We're, as I use the Star Trek analogies, they're putting up their shields and powering up their weapons, waiting for a fight. And quite honestly, I've gotten to the point, and I'm only 56, and I've gotten to the point where I've actually disabled and removed my shields. I've said, I've had enough. And if I'm going to be killed, I'm ready to go. Okay, I've had enough. I'm not going to sit here and spar over whatever it is. And that's not to say that I don't get wound up sometimes over certain subjects. I do. But I'm tired of the drama. I really am. It just grates on me, the fact that people have to have the drama. Why can't we thrive in our lives? And what you're offering women across the spectrum is that opportunity for the first time in their lives to thrive.
That's right. That's my goal. You know, the Supreme Love Project was founded specifically to help women to identify the parts of themselves that have been accosted by relational and social terrors, to name some of the culprits and some of the origins of their pain body. So women who are anxious and depressed, who are indecisive, who are suffering from insomnia, who are having trouble maintaining relationships, who can't find their voice, who don't know what healthy boundaries are, they can come to the SupremeLoveProject.com and connect with me, connect with other women who are a part of the project, and really get some frameworks to anchor themselves in some understanding so that you can stop spinning out in a cycle of grief and pain, feeling confused and cloudy, and sort of not knowing what hit you. There's a way that you can put your anchor down and put your feet firmly on a foundation that you can build yourself, and you can actually deconstruct your old toxic reactionary lover identity and then build up a supreme lover identity so that you can create revolutions in your life. It's not over.
There's a line on your website that says, you need another lover.
You do. You do. What I say to women is, you need another lover. You need another lover identity. You don't necessarily need another boyfriend or another husband or a companion or a spouse. I mean, boys will come. Men are everywhere. You know, I'm not really excited about that. I feel like, you know, when you develop your lover identity and you become the luscious, gorgeous, powerful, wise, tenacious, vivacious, confident human being that you were designed to be, you're not going to worry about getting a boyfriend.
Yeah. They'll come. They'll flock. They'll flock to you.
Yeah, that's not the subject at all. What I say is you need another lover, which means you need yourself.
Yes.
All sisters who are listening, you need yourself.
There's a wonderful poem. Last name of the author, I think, is, my goodness. I want to say Tiberius, but I'm not sure if that's correct. Anyway, the poem in its synopsis is that the gods are trying to hide something from man because man is, you know, he's evolving and he's becoming more aware of himself and so forth. And he wants, man wants to be like the gods. Well, the gods, of course, have the secret, you know, but they need a place to hide it. And of course, they all are talking about, well, we'll hide it on the mountaintop. No, he'll find a way to climb it. And we'll hide it in the depths of the earth. No, he'll find a way to get down there. We'll hide it on another star somewhere. No, he'll find a way to get there, and on and on and on. Finally, one says, I know. We'll hide it in his heart. He'll never look there.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? Yeah.
And so it just, you know, I applaud you and congratulate you for what you've created for people, for women in particular, in the Supreme Love Project. Also, the book that goes along with the project itself is called The Revelations of Asher, and it's available through her website, JeaneStaples.com, or you can go to TheSupremeLoveProject.com. And Jeanine, before I let you go, first of all, I would like to extend to you an invitation that if should you find yourself in the Santa Barbara area, we'd love to have you in studio to continue this conversation.
Oh, absolutely. Richard, I would definitely like to come. This has been really great. And I want to thank you for extending this invitation and for taking the time. It's been really wonderful. Thank you.
You are very welcome. Also to our listeners, if you are listening to the radio broadcast, there's more. I always tell you to check the audio file, some call them podcasts, I call them archives, at the website on the radio show's page. We only have 50 minutes for the radio show, but it goes on. I don't know how long. You're going to have to go to the website and click on the play button associated with Jeanine Staples' interview and listen to the entire interview. Some great stuff has been said. And before I let you go, Jeanine, I have one set of three questions, final questions that I ask, try to ask all of my guests. You may have answered them in one shape or form during the program, but I'd like to put them to you. And whatever comes to mind, please share it with us. The first one is, who is Jeanine Staples?
I'm a supreme lover. And that makes me a divinely oriented scholar, educator, and coach. That means I am a spirit. I steward my soul responsibly, and I reside in my body. I preside over my own kingdom, and I am in the process of developing my lover identity to higher heights so that I can continually heal the terrors in my soul and in my soma and launch spectacular revolutions in the world.
So what you're telling me is it's Queen Jeanine.
That's correct.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
I want to achieve mass. I want to support the generation of 1 million souls, just 1 million women who self-identify as supreme lovers, who are able to access the supreme love healing methodology, do that healing methodology in their own soul, in their own soma, in their own kingdom, and launch revolutions in the world.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
My purpose is to contribute to the end of human suffering. So my research, my education, my coaching, the way that I do work in the world, all of it leads back to contributing methodologies, research, teaching and instructional practices, coaching support to contribute to the end of human suffering.
Well, if it's not inappropriate to say so, let me just respond by saying, you go, girl.
Thanks, Richard.
Jeanine, again, thank you so much. Jeanine Staples, JeanineStaples.com or TheSupremeLoveProject.com. And we encourage you to go to the website, her website. Either of those will get you to the book, The Revelations of Asher, as well as the information and become a part of the Supreme Love Project and get the support that you can help to turn your life in a direction that is going to not only support you, but the people around you. Jeanine, I've often said on this program that there are two myths that are lies. One of them is that sticks and stones may break your bones, but words will never hurt you. A lie. The other is, as my mother used to tell me, you can't change other people. It's a lie. Because what happens when you change yourself, you not only change the people around you as far as who associates with you, those who choose not to associate with you are changed because they have to deal with the new you. And if they can't handle the new you, bye-bye. Yeah. And you freed yourself from some unnecessary baggage. So again, I'm very excited with what you have put together. And again, we thank you for joining us here on the program. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to Lal. And we are clear.